What does the elevation of Donald Trump and his policies on trade mean for the global economy? What will dramatic reductions of the corporate tax rate in America mean for the most financially compromised Americans? What were the real reasons Trump prevailed over Clinton in the recent elections? Does the recent round of executive orders on the U.S.-Mexico border wall, immigration policy, pipelines, and other initiatives bring us any closer to understanding the agenda of the deep state forces which secured his election? Do the recent high-profile spats with the CIA suggest that Trump's days in office may be numbered? On this edition of the Global Research NewsHour, we continue our discussion from last time about the incoming Trump administration, where its policies will take us, and what they mean for America and the world. We'll hear perspectives from PhD economist Rodrigue Tremblay and from political watcher and commentator Stephen Lendman. On this week's program, Trump and the Deep State, Part 2. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research NewsHour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 27th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, an occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. U.S. War Crimes Act and 18 U.S.C. sections 818 and 3231 punish torture, willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health, and inhuman, humiliating, or degrading treatment. And the torture statute criminalizes the commission, attempt, or conspiracy to commit torture outside the United States. Trump said he would approve the use of waterboarding, quote, in a heartbeat, unquote, because, quote, only a stupid person would say it doesn't work, unquote. But even if it doesn't work, he added, quote, they deserve it anyway for what they're doing, unquote. Trump, who relies on alternative facts, quote unquote, probably doesn't care if torture works to get the real facts. That comes from the article State-Sanctioned Torture in the Age of Trump by Marjorie Cohn, posted January 26th, originally appearing at Truth Out. Peru is clearly aware that South America is sailing through turbulent waters and is, at the same time, affronted by an aggressive campaign to harass it. In addition to economic woes, the region is the victim of a powerful offensive driven from outside that seeks, through all kinds of means, to consolidate Washington's presence. U.S. military incursions in the region are advancing at an accelerated pace. This is partly due to several governments turning to the right, especially after Mauricio Macri assumed the presidency of Argentina and the parliamentary impeachment of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, and partly due to the tireless effort to undermine the influence of countries such as China, Russia, and Iran. Arming Peru right to the teeth represents a vital pawn for the United States to succeed further down the line in setting up other military bases in Argentina at its border with Brazil and Paraguay. That comes from the article, South America Under Threat, U.S. to set up a new military base in Peru, by Ariel Noyola Rodriguez, posted January 26th, translated by Anusha Borolesa for Voltaire Network. The march failed so far in the sense that Trump is president, but it succeeded in the sense that a pacified population could let off steam and publicly disapprove of Trump. I don't follow MSM, so I don't know all the stories invented about Trump, apart from golden showers or whatever the allegation was. But Trump says he wants peace with Russia, and he talks about dissolving the NATO terror organization, etc., which is preferable to war criminal Hillary's threats against Syria and Iran and the world. Meanwhile, amidst the spectacles, the distractions, and the controlled opposition, The slaughters and beheadings and genocide continue apace overseas. Voices from what remains of the quote-unquote progressive movement are barely audible, and the quote-unquote left has been almost completely co-opted. That comes from the article Women's March for Misogyny by Mark Taliano, posted January 26th. The idea of establishing a quote-unquote safe zone in Syria is, of course, not a new concept. In July 2015, the agreement being discussed would have effectively created a buffer zone that would have spanned from the Turkish borderline into Syria. It would have extended from Azaz in the east to Jarablus in the west and as far south as Al-Bab. The width of the zone would have been about 68 miles and would have extended around 40 miles deep into Syria, right on the doorstep of Aleppo. That buffer zone was actually created with Turkey's Operation Euphrates Shield, and it has functioned as the last open NATO-protected supply line for ISIS and its allies to enter Syria from Turkey. That comes from the article, Trump Expected to Sign Orders for Safe Zone in Syria, reports, by Brandon Turbeville, post January 26th, originally appearing at Activist Post. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
On this week's episode of the Global Research News Hour, I'm going to be talking with Rodrigue Tremblay. Dr. Tremblay is a PhD economist. He graduated from Stanford University. He is since now the emeritus professor at the University of Montreal. And Dr. Tremblay has written a number of articles about world political economy. You can find many of them on globalresearch.ca, as well as his own blog, The New American Empire. I believe it's .blogspot.com, but you can just search The New American Empire. He's the author of two books. His most recent is The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles, as well as The New American Empire. I want to welcome you to the show, Dr. Tremblay.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Amlin.
Okay, so certainly in the news lately, in the world political stage, is the election of Donald J. Trump to the U.S. presidency. We've covered this a number of times on the Global Research News Hour, but we definitely want to talk to you this time about some of the economic dimensions of the Trump presidency and where what we can expect in the future. If we could just begin, I understand that the conversation these days about Trump is very charged. There's a lot of ideology out there. It seems like a lot of people are very pro-Trump or anti-Trump. Can we just kind of lay our cards on the table and kind of show where you kind of fit in terms of your overall impression of the Trump administration before we get into some of the details?
Well, as the Chinese say, we are living in interesting times. And I think the election of Mr. Trump last November will have tremendous consequences, not only for the United States, but I think for the world, because Mr. Trump has a program to reverse what has been the U.S. policy, the American policy, since 1945. So reversing a course of action that has lasted for 70 years is bound to have consequences and create turbulence. Therefore, this is a phenomenon. Mr. Trump is a political, is a businessman, of course, who became a politician. And this is a phenomenon that many political scientists and journalists and analysts will study in the years to come, because as we have seen during the first year, the first week of his administration, he has set up in motion a lot of changes through decrees, and this will unfold in the coming weeks, months, and years to come.
Okay, so you mentioned that over the last 70 years, there's been something of a consensus in terms of how America will lead the world economy and the world political situation, and you talked about this abrupt change. Let's unpack that a little bit and look at the different dimensions of the change. So I've read that you've talked about one issue we could think about is trade integration. So over the last 70 years, we have something like globalization, the expansion of multilateral trade agreements, the integration of regional and then supranational economies. And it looks like Trump is at least talking about reversing some of that. Could you speak to some of the economic issues there and what you see going forward?
Well, yes. I think Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, is a throwback of 100 years back. In other words, we are going back to Colin in the 1920s when we had Republican administration that were very much isolationist and protectionist. So it's not only that we go back to 1945. I think we go back even before 1945 as far as American vision of the world. So what happened during the election? I'm sorry. During the election, the 2016 election, people tend to confound the messenger, who is Mr. Trump, and the message. And 70 million Americans voted for the message, even if many of them didn't like very much Mr. Trump himself, being somewhat obnoxious and bullying and throwing attacks right and left. But the message may have been left lost to many people. As you mentioned, and as I raised the issue, since 1945, through the GATT and through the WTO, the World Trade Organization, with the creation of the United Nations, the United States government was a leader of expanding a worldview of affairs. And the belief was that countries should not be going for their own narrow interests, but look to the general interest in order to keep peace in the world. And that's why all these institutions, the IMF, the World WTO, and all these other organizations were created. Unfortunately, as far as from an economic point of view, there was a flaw in that approach, and that flaw appears especially in the last 25 years. Before the last 25 years, the emphasis was based on creating more trade between nations in order to have more specializations, better productivity, and raise the standard of living of every country. But about 25 years ago, the idea became that corporations, manufacturers, should be able to move from one country freely. So from free trade, we added the free movement of corporations. And this is something which is not economically sound, in the sense that labor forces in every country are immobile as far as geography is concerned. People cannot move from one country if they are unemployed to get employment in another country. But when corporations move their capital and their technology to other countries in order to profit from low wages and better conditions of production, that left behind, this has two main effects. Probably first, it leaves behind unemployed peoples or underemployed peoples in the country from where they come from. And the second thing also, it reduces the benefits from free trade. Free trade is supposed to be based on comparative economic advantages of each country, specializing in different industries. But when you move your corporations and your technology to another country, then you lose some of your comparative advantages. And many people resent that. And I believe that even if people didn't articulate these things during the last elections, many people, the 70 million people who voted for Mr. Trump, even though 73 million supported for Mrs. Clinton. They felt that the U.S. has been a bit too generous in moving its corporations abroad, its technology, and the benefits of many under-educated Americans have been zero or sometimes negative, and that's the reason why they voted for Mr. Trump, even though maybe they didn't like his approach, they like his message.
Mm-hmm. So you do see an internal logic, a rational argument to be made for some sort of backing up from the type of globalization that we've had. But if I understand, you also have a concern about what that could mean for the global economy. We've had retreats from globalization before, earlier on in the 20th century and at various points in the 19th century. And one of the advantages of multilateral free trade is that reduces the inclination to use trade policy as a political tool. And it keeps you out of trade wars and things that really don't help your economy. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Oh, yes. As I mentioned in my article, What to Expect from the Trump Administration, I raised 10 issues that I fear Mr. Trump, his administration may go too far, too fast, and throw the baby of free trade with the bad water of offshore sourcing of jobs by large corporations. That's what I'm afraid with Mr. Trump, is that he may confuse the two. Free trade is good for every nation if it is done within the rules, but the movement of international corporations and the movement of technology may benefit the world in total, but may hurt the country that loses its competitive advantages.
Right.
And therefore, a debate should be carried in the U.S., and I will hope that the American economists, especially from universities, will enter into that debate, because there seems to be a confusion in the political debate in the U.S., between free trade and free movement of international corporations. And that will be very negative if free trade were cast aside and create a lot of dislocation in many economies, and everybody will lose, including the United States, because if the United States has been benefiting tremendously from free trade, probably the country that has benefited the most since 1945. And therefore, as I said in my article, I ask Mr. Trump to be careful in destroying three-quarter of a century of policy in a few days or in a few weeks, because the world doesn't function like that. Companies don't function like that. And that would be very detrimental for the United States, would be detrimental for the world economy, and for the Mexican and the Canadian economy in particular. North America can be destabilized.
Okay, we only have so much time, so let's switch gears and talk about income inequality. The rise of Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side really brought to light some of the real political force of income inequality. We have the Occupy movement talking about the 1%, and there really is a concern out there that today income inequality is rising and this is not sustainable and is at odds with democracy. Do you think that the Trump economic agenda overall should increase or reduce income inequality, and why?
Well, that's the big question, of course, because you are right. The rise in inequality, income and wealth inequality, is a throwback to the 1920s and the 1930s. And this is well documented. And the danger is that if Mr. Trump and his administration push forward the wrong policies, they may increase inequality rather than decrease it. In other words, make the rich richer and the poor poorer. That will be a destruction, in a sense, of what people are expecting, because during the election in 2016, people voted for the message of Mr. Trump, that they wanted to improve things economically for the very people that Mrs. Clinton called the deplorable, the poorly educated Americans. He wanted to stop outsourcing of American jobs abroad by American corporations. And he, Mr. Trump, captured the resentments and the frustrations, economic and social, of many discontent Americans about the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and about, of course, also the political gridlock in Washington, D.C., where very little can be done. But if he goes too far and dislocate the large American corporations, their productivity will go down, and they won't be able to bring back all the jobs that have been established in China or in Mexico. There will be a lot of frictions. We may end up into having trade wars like in the 1930s, where we had the Smoot-Hawley Act in the United States passed in the 1930s, which raised a large border, high border tax on imported goods. My advice to Mr. Trump is that don't confuse things. Don't confuse things. Don't touch free trade, but you may tax American corporations that leave $2 or $3 trillions of dollars in tax havens, bring that money back to the U.S. for investments, invest in new technology and in new plants. That's very good, but don't confuse things. And I think there's a level of confusion in both Mr. Trump's mind and in his in some of his advisors that I've heard on radio or TV. And that's my fear, that there's not enough clear view of what should be done to improve things for everybody, including, of course, mainly, to begin with, American workers and the middle class in the U.S. who has been suffering from the rise in the inequalities over the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot there. I want to follow up on the tax issue. Trump has talked about a couple things. One of them is lowering the corporate tax on profits from 35% to 15%. He's also has ideas for a wide-ranging tax overhaul, which would simplify the tax code and bring down especially marginal rates quite a bit. When you look at that, the Center for Tax Policy Analysis in the U.S. has said that a lot of that would have a regressive effect on income. Do you accept the argument that by that these tax cuts will create jobs and in the long term maybe even be neutral or positive for income equality?
Well, there again, there's always a problem of reaching for something and ending with another result. Of course, it would be very feasible for the Trump administration to tax foreign profits by American corporations differently than domestic profits. If it were done that way, that would be helpful to the U.S. economy. But if they keep lowering taxes, by the way, the real corporate tax in the U.S. is not 35%. This is on the book, on the books. But the main, the average corporate tax, real corporate tax, is about 12.5%. Therefore, if they keep lowering the tax, corporate taxes lower, and at the same time they want to reduce the deficit, then they will have to touch the entitlement and the social programs that the U.S. government has. Of course, we're talking about the Obamacare, but Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and all that. And then the poor Americans would be, the poorest American would be the most suffering from these lowering of public expenditures for social purposes. And therefore, inequality may increase. So it's not a sure thing that, just by lowering taxes for corporations that you will get the result. It has to be a more precise approach of taxes. And of course, if they raise the border tax on all imports, then that will hurt everybody.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the market has voted itself on the Trump when you have a noticeable increase in market valuations on the stock market. There's reports that small business confidence has dramatically increased since the election of Trump. What do you think is behind the popular perception, at least in the business community, that Trump will be good for business?
Well, there are three main reasons. The first, of course, if you announce that you're going to lower corporate taxes, that means that after-tax profits for corporations will be larger, higher, and therefore their market valuation is higher. That's a reason. The second reason, the Trump administration wants to abolish many regulations that small companies, small corporations like to be abolished, and therefore that's another plus. And of course, it wants to set forward $1 trillion over 10 years of infrastructure expenditures that will create jobs for small and medium-sized companies. So this is understandable. Although I will say that the stock market now is in the bubble and in the last phase of that bubble. So in the next 2 years, we'll expect a big reversal of the stock market when the Fed keeps increasing interest rates and the Trump policies become more visible in its effects, in its negative effects, then the stock market may tank.
Mm-hmm. In the U.S., the health sector is such a big part of the economy. It's hard to have a discussion about the U.S. economy without talking about healthcare. Of course, Trump has promised to repeal and replace Obamacare. He's basically said the system doesn't work. More recently, he's talked about renegotiating prices with drug companies, and basically just taking a lot of actions that he thinks will benefit the sector in alignment with a free market orientation. How do you see things on the healthcare side in terms of the Trump agenda and the economy?
Well, that's a big question that nobody knows, because the Trump administration hasn't proposed a detailed replacement for the Obamacare. Mind you, the Obamacare was a Republican ID. It came from Mr. Romney's when he was governor of Massachusetts. And the Obama administration would have preferred to have a Canadian approach of a single-payer approach to health care. So this is something which is left in the... It has to be made more precise in the weeks and months ahead, because there's confusion now. There are many plans which have been advanced to replace. Most of them are going to the states, but some states are poorer than others in the U.S., like in any country, and more to the private sector. My feeling is that this will be very difficult to square the circle with that approach. And some people, there are 20 million Americans who had no health coverage before the Obamacare. Some of them may be left aside and be the victim of that program.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
the genius of Mr. Trump's approach was to make a coalition between the Bible Belt supporters and the Rust Belt supporters. And this creates a tremendous coalition in the sense that he ended up winning most of the Midwest American states, and he ended up winning Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, the Rust Belt states, while the Democrats were left with the western coast, California, Oregon, and the east coast, New York, and so on. And now we see that Mr. Trump is very aware of that coalition. He's paying his political debt. Of course, he got a lot, when he made a speech in front of the APEC conference on March 21st, American-Israel Political Action Committee, he got a lot of donors after that speech, and that was very helpful to his campaign. And from the Bible Belt, he's paying his debts now. He's trying to make abortion more difficult to obtain. And he promised to pack the U.S. Supreme Court with pro-life judges, the like of Judge and late Judge Antonin Scalia. And to the Rust Belt, of course, he proposed protectionism to the repatriation of jobs which have been outsourced to low-labor countries by American corporations, and to renegotiate the international trade and investment agreements. And to those who are afraid of mass immigration and terrorism, of course, he wants to close the borders, make them tighter against illegal immigration, build a wall against Mexico and all that. So people are maybe underestimated the political ability of Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump is not a stupid politician. He is very acute politician who knows how to build the coalition much more than Mrs. Clinton was. Mrs. Clinton proposed some sort of a status quo, more a third term for Mr. Obama. But Mr. Trump went on the offensive and created that tremendous coalition. And that coalition may not be reduced in the years ahead, as many people think. It may expand, as other experiences in Europe of that type of populist politics show. Therefore, we are at the beginning of a process, political process in the U.S., and not at the end.
Okay, you mentioned a number of different types of social forces that supported the election of Trump. What do you think about the old dictum from Bill Clinton that it's the economy, stupid? He said this basically in response to George Bush saying that the real issue that people care about, we can talk about a lot of different social issues, but when it comes down to it, it's do people have a job? Are they making a living wage? Do you think that was of primary importance in this election?
I'm 100% in agreement with that statement. And I think former President Bill Clinton told his wife that she should have talked more about the economy, because people vote their wallet. And if they are unemployed or they have trouble paying their rent and all that, then no matter if the guy is has a bad reputation, but if somebody comes and says, I'm going to help you, they tend to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple as that. As a matter of fact, Professor Lickerman from the University of Washington had a program that had predicted the election for the last, since 1980s, and it predicted the election of Mr. Trump when all the polls were showing that Mrs. Clinton would be elected. And the main reason is because people wanted change to improve their social condition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way most people think when they are in that situation. Of course, people who have no problems can vote their ideology. But people who face economic problems vote their wallet.
Okay, I want to actually take a step back and talk about an issue that you just raised in your previous comments, and that was on immigration. Traditionally, you can think immigration comes down to, on the one hand, you're bringing in new talents to the economy, you're diversifying the labor pool, and so you can think of possible advantages of immigration. But on the other hand, there's a concern that if you already have unemployment, then further immigration will just further depress wages and hurt the economy. Trump has talked about certainly ending illegal immigration. Perhaps he's more neutral on legal immigration. How do you think the Trump immigration policy will interface with the economy?
Mr. Trump is on the right track when he talks about immigration and the economy, even if it's not very well articulated. If you are in a free trade environment, where you can import labor-intensive goods and export capital and technology-intensive goods in exchange, you don't need as many immigrants as in the past. In the past, when you had protectionism, you had the textile industries, labor-intensive industries, then you could have a lot of immigration. But when you can import labor-intensive goods, you need less immigration. And if you don't do that, if you have a mass immigration policy, as we have in Canada and the U.S., that leaves the uneducated part of your population aside, because they have to compete with low-wage laborers coming from abroad, and their standard of living declines. And these people are going to vote against immigration for sure. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the U.S., of course, they have illegal immigration. They have more than 10 million illegal immigrants from Mexico and from South America. Therefore, there's a real problem there. And the Democrats refuse to talk about that real problem. They stick to their ideology instead of talking about the real problems. At least in the case of Mr. Trump, and I don't want to defend him because I'm afraid of many of his policies, but at least he talked about the problems that the people were facing, mm-hmm. While other politicians talk about ideology and the vision of the world that they had, a new world order or whatever. Therefore, the question of immigration is not only a question of a big topic in the U.S., it's a big topic in Canada, and it's a huge topic in Europe. If the European Union disintegrates, it would be because of that of immigration policy by Bruxelles.
That's it for this episode of the Global Research News Hour. You are listening to Dr. Rodrigue Tremblay. He is a PhD economist, educated at Stanford, and current professor emeritus at the University of Montreal. You can check out his most latest article on globalresearch.ca, What to Expect from the Trump Administration, a Protectionist and Pro-Corporate American Government. My name is Colin Hanlon. Thank you for listening to the show.
Objectionable as President Trump and his policies may be, this program has been trying to ascertain what the deep state or power behind the throne is up to. Why was Trump allowed to prevail over Clinton in what is recognized as a rigged system? The deep state seems to be divided over Trump, and we're looking to determine if last week's announcements lead us any closer to learning what the overall game plan is. Meanwhile, Trump has been getting into high-profile fights with the Central Intelligence Agency. Is Trump vulnerable to some sort of overthrow? And if so, how and when would that take place? To discuss these issues, I thought I would bring back Stephen Lenman back to the program. He's an award-winning investigative journalist and blogger. He is the host of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network and a frequent contributor to Global Research. Stephen Lenman, it's good to have you back on the show.
Oh, Michael, thank you very much. It's good to be back on with you.
Could you, I know you just recently, as we're having this conversation, you just posted a new essay, basically. It's called Trump's Disturbing First Week in Office. Would you care to just give us a quick review of the last 7 days, you know, from the inauguration to the fights with the CIA and delays over the Pompeo nomination, the executive orders? What stands out for you about what we can expect from Trump and his agenda?
What I covered in my article, Michael, I didn't go back to the post-election immediately after November 8th. I just covered his first week in office, and I began saying that he responsibly pulled out of the TPP, the trade deal, just a terrible trade deal. And that was a key issue that he raised throughout his campaign, the fact that America's jobs are being offshored to cheap labor countries. He wants to bring jobs back. I don't know that he'll be able to do that, but if he can figure out a way to get companies to create more jobs in America instead of sending them overseas, that's marvelous. But aside from that, it's been all downhill. I mean, you mentioned the various issues. There have been others. Another one, brand new, I believe, as of yesterday, wanting to oppose a 20% import tax on Mexican products and likely on China as well, what the percentage would be. Who knows? It could be 20%, it could be 10%, it could be any percentage. If he's got this idea in Mexico to pay for his ill-conceived Great Wall, as I call it, also to get more jobs staying in America, he believes that NAFTA is a terrible deal, and it is. There was a terrible fight in the Congress, I remember very well, and it passed by a very, very close vote. It never should have passed at all. It's a disgraceful trade deal. It's destroyed, I believe, over 1 million U.S. jobs. So the touted as a jobs creator, it's been a jobs destroyer. So Trump is on the right track wanting to get rid of things like this. He talks about renegotiating it. What he should do is trash it all together and just start all over again, having not free trade between America and Mexico and Canada and all other countries, but fair trade. And America certainly does not have fair trade now. So much more, Michael, I'll let you jump back in.
Okay. Well, I am curious then, I mentioned also there are the fights with the CIA, these very, and now the delays over his nominee for CIA director Pompeo. Where do you think that's leading? Is that just a big show, or is there some fundamental beef that the CIA or some faction of the CIA has with Trump? What do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, of course, the CIA was involved with I think the FBI got dragged along, maybe reluctantly. But CIA, FBI, NSA, Department of Homeland Security, DHS, conspired to come up with this cockamamie idea that Russia interfered in America's election. And, of course, Russia had nothing to do with hacking anything or doing anything interfering with America's election. So Trump has and the idea being to delegitimize Trump, maybe undermine his agenda, whatever it turns out to be as it unfolds. And I mean, he certainly has a great deal of right to be angry about this. But when he went to CIA headquarters, I guess it was a bit of a peace offering. And I was amazed to learn that he only addressed about 300 or 400 people. He didn't have a room or whatever facility set up big enough to hold the numbers who wanted to see him. Apparently, as many as 1,000 wanted to hear what he had to say. So only a few hundred got in. But at the end of his talk, Michael, he got a 5-minute standing ovation. Can you imagine that? So, I mean, I guess the lower level people at CIA support him. Maybe not surprising, but they're not the ones who make the decisions. Others make the decisions. Trump has his own man at CIA, Pompeo, and Mike Pompeo, and John Brennan is out. Trump came down very hard on John Brennan. John Brennan came down very hard on Trump. So at least he has his own man in power there. We'll have to see what happens. I mean, if Trump goes along with the system, part of the establishment and so on, at least for the most part, he'll probably get along very well with the CIA. But if he diverges too much, he could be in very big trouble. Either the CIA, especially, Michael, isn't impeachment. It's taking out anybody by much more sinister means. Mm-hmm. But he could be impeached by the Congress and removed. But a couple of presidents impeached. Nobody's ever been removed by impeachment. Trump could end up being the first one.
Yeah. There were a lot of questions circulating. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was rather surprised that Trump ended up winning the election. Not to say that I was a big Hillary supporter, but it seemed clear that a significant chunk of the ruling establishment including obviously much of the mainstream media, were backing Clinton. And I was expecting Clinton to emerge by fair means or foul, because we know elections are often rigged. And I'm wondering if we do you have a better understanding now of what happened? I mean, was there some sort of a mid-course correction, as you point out in one of your articles, that Hillary was damaged goods and they changed on the fly to support Trump? Was there some sort of a deal that was cut? Do you have any better insights now on exactly why Trump is commander-in-chief and not Hillary?
Well, probably the answer will come out long after I'm dead and gone, Michael.
Me too, probably.
When declassified stuff becomes unclassified, and we all know, I think there's no question that Hillary thought absolutely for certain she would be the next president. And in a couple of my articles, I made comments like, get used to hearing Madam President. And you remember what Newsweek did, came out with a preliminary cover, Madam President, on it. It reminded me of the Chicago Tribune in 1948 saying, Dewey wins.
Yeah.
And Truman saying I quoted him saying, ain't the way I heard it. A terrific quote. We don't know. I suspect the things might have come together late in the game, because I can't imagine Hillary wasn't piped in on what the devil is going on. I mean, her husband and ex-president, she certainly the favorite, the media darling, to say the least. And she had to have some idea about what the heck was going on. It could have been something that came together very, very late in the game, Michael. And she rented a ballroom. I don't forget the hotel she was in, a facility she was in, that I believe had a glass ceiling to represent her breaking it. And of course, with fireworks and everything else ready to go as soon as her election was announced, and it never happened. So it could have been this all came together very late in the game. And the only thing I can imagine is that the powers that be did think that she was too tainted, and they decided to go with Trump, wanting to control him enough. And if they couldn't, then get rid of him and go with Pence.
There's something I picked up. It was one of a commentary by Larry Chin, and who was talk, which was posted on the Global Research site, and it mentioned these emails that from the private server, and that were they had a collection of them on the Anthony Weiner site, and what he mentioned was that there may have been some, you know, between that and the Clinton Foundation activities, there may have been information that may have been damaging to deep state, you know, black op, clandestine operations that really compromised, you know, a deep operation that even more important than who becomes president. And so some action needed to be taking place to counter, or at some level she was a threat to some certain entrenched interests, and that's why they went with Trump, and maybe cut a deal along the way. And I don't know if maybe Mike Pence was part of that deal, because it seems as if he would be acceptable to the deep state, even if Trump's, who's given to certain sorts of idiosyncratic behavior, is maybe potentially problematic. So, but I tend to see Mike Pence as insurance, in the event that Trump steps out of line.
Oh, I agree with everything you said, and the fact also that Hillary used her home server. And I mean, this stuff with a Democrat Party insiders not too happy with her for stealing the nomination from Bernie Sanders. I think this is the reason the leaks, maybe the original reason for the stuff leaking in the first place. Certainly wasn't hacked by Russia, but it was leaked by one or more Party insiders. And there's a whole lot more stuff that hasn't come out. There's 650,000 emails that the FBI managed to review in 24 hours.
Yeah.
Or 48 or 72 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, heaven only knows what stuff was in that. I mean, there could be some stuff, and it could be floating around, and maybe there could be some more leaks exposing more stuff. I think the powers that be may be very concerned about the Hillary information that just might at some point become public. I really do believe that she became damaged goods. There was just so much floating around. Even the major media couldn't hide everything rotten about her. I mean, the worst stuff they kept under wraps, but certainly a lot of it came out, and it probably came down to, let's go with Trump Pence, and we got Pence, who certainly, and he had to be in on this too. We've got Pence as a good backup, and we'll go with him if we have to. And it's only 7 days into Trump's administration, Michael, so it's really too early to judge him. I'm not at all happy with what's gone on so far, and I mean, it really is an indication of what's likely to come, but we got to give him more time and see what happens. We'll see. I'm not optimistic. That I will say absolutely.
Is there anything that's come out in the last week that's that caught you off guard? You know, for better or for worse, that you didn't see coming.
I'm surprised he's done so much so fast. I know enough about U.S. history and U.S. politics never to get too optimistic about a new administration. The only president I ever respected was Jack Kennedy, and he didn't come in as a peacemaker. He transformed himself in office, and that's the reason they got rid of him. It wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. CIA just bumped him off to get rid of him, and Lyndon Johnson was their man, and there were rumors that George H.W. Bush was involved, and even talk of Nixon being involved. My memory's a little foggy on that. It's been so long since I read some stuff on it. But he had to go, and that was a lesson for all future presidents. You don't mess with the system, because if you do, you may not be around very long. It's so easy to get rid of everybody. The president I think of as a front man for the power system, and he or she, it's always been a he, one day it'll be a she, will either go along with that system or be in very big trouble, unless somewhere way down the road something happens, a revolution or something in America, and the system changes. But it's an entire history, 240-odd years or so. It's always been the same thing. Never been anything different. There's no democracy in America. People who think that America is a democracy are living in a dream world. There simply isn't any. We have a one-party state with two right wings. There used to be a little differentiation between the wings way back, but at least since the neoliberal 90s, that all ended. So we really have, you could call them Republicrats or reverse the terminology, and it's one party, and they take turns who put their people into power. But this is the way the country is run. The people have no say about anything, and I just can't see anything happening ahead that's going to be good for the ordinary people of the country. More neoliberal harshness, more maybe the war's continuing. No doubt the war's continuing, whether it's the same scenario as under Obama, Bush, Cheney, the Clintons, I don't know. But I don't see anything changing very, very much. I think Trump will go along with most of it, but we'll see. He'll probably get his way on some things, but on the stuff that the deep state does not want any divergence from, he'll either play ball or he won't be around very long, Michael.
Mm. Now, Stephen, do you see anything in the way Trump has conducted himself? I mean, is this guy what he appears to be, a buffoon, or is there anything that he's doing or saying which is, you know, with the hidden dog whistle-ish intent of sending a message to those powers that be, either to defend himself or some other mechanism like that? Because I mean, I assume he knows that he is under threat if he's, as you say, if he doesn't play ball. I mean, is he determined to defy those entities, and does he have the ability to defend himself or otherwise? Do you see him sending these sorts of meta messages out there that the rest of us are maybe oblivious to and misinterpreting?
Well, of course, he can't he can't defy the system and win the game, Michael. There's no question about that. But he's said things and done things as president. I, in my lifetime, never heard or saw before. I mean, he's attacked the major media. Who ever heard of a president attacking the major media? He's come down hard. Yeah. We call him a bunch of liars and stuff like that.
But is that deliberate, is there some sort of, like, is there a method to his madness, or is this just him popping off because he's insane?
Well, I mean, the media certainly went after him, and they're still going after him. He made that lying comment in his talk at CIA headquarters. I think the people there appreciated it. I think he got a round of applause when he said that. And he went after the previous CIA head, John Brennan, really attacked him savagely. I think the last president who did that was Jack Kennedy. I don't know if he named the CIA director, but he said he wanted to tear the agency into 1,000 pieces, get rid of the agency. He made a mistake. He thought he might go after them in his second term, and there never was a second term. But Trump may be settling down. He's got his own man at CIA. He's made some very tough comments. I'll watch what he says ahead. If he keeps up this diatribe against the way America is run, the establishment and so on, then he certainly will be different straight down the road. It could be a lot of the stuff that he's done has been rhetoric, and he'll simply get back on track and go along with the system. But again, it's so early in the game, Michael, we don't know.
Well, I hear what you're saying there, but I can't resist asking one more question. Is there a specific policy? I mean, we know with Kennedy, the general feeling is that it was around Cuba and backing away from moving away from that militaristic stance that seemed to be the death knell for his administration and his life. Where do you anticipate Trump might cross the line and effectively be replaced, either through impeachment or some other means?
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. If he makes rapprochement with Vladimir Putin, and they both cooperate with each other, and maybe even silently they become buddies. Silent buddies. I mean, if he gets along with Putin and they cooperate with each other, especially if he tries getting rid of the sanctions, that could be the coup de grace for him. He could be a goner if he does that. I mean, I would imagine 100% of, maybe not 100%, but close to 100% of the Congress against doing something like that. He's on track being anti-China, being rough on China, being rough on Iran. But if he gets along with Putin and they cooperate with each other, and we see nice pleasantries exchanged between the two of them, and we see the cooperation in what is happening, like Trump's as America's commander in chief stops intervening militarily against other countries and concentrates only on combating terrorism with Russia and anybody else. That would definitely go against the system, and that could be the end of the line for him.
Okay. Well, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen. As always, we appreciate your analysis and your contributions to our program and the site.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael. There's so much going on. There'll be so much more to talk about ahead.
Absolutely. I've been speaking with Stephen Lendman, an award-winning investigative journalist and the host of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Be sure to check out his blog, sjlendman.blogspot.ca, as well as his regular contributions to the Global Research website.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to this week's guest contributor, Colin Hamlin. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.